From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Philip Lopate has nothing against pleasure. What he doesn't like is a smug, upbeat, flaunting style of enjoyment. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Lopate about his collection of essays against joie de vivre. Also today, poet and essayist John Haynes talks with us about his decades in the Alaskan wilderness. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete galaxy recordings of Art Pepper, more than 18 hours of music from the late alto saxophonist. And TV critic David Bianculli looks back on 10 years of ABC's Nightline. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A half a million East Germans poured into the streets of Leipzig today to demand free elections and unlimited freedom to travel abroad. More than 135,000 people rallied in other cities across the country, while East Germans at home protested. Mass flight continued. An official news agency, ADN, said more than 23,000 East Germans had gone to the West since the suspension of exit rules on Saturday. On the eve of Namibia's pre-independence elections, a light aircraft operating on behalf of one of the leading political parties was shot at and forced to make an emergency landing. The incident happened near the Angolan border, the BBC's Mike Woolridge reports.
Police in Kavango are quoted by the South African Press Association as saying that the plane was broadcasting DTA political messages when it was fired at, apparently by small arms. The charter company could not confirm this. It said the plane was hit, and the pilot, who was accompanied by one unidentified passenger, made an emergency landing at Andara. He and the passenger were able to jump clear just before the part of the plane caught fire. The pilot has said he did not stray over the Angolan border. There is as yet no clue as to who might have fired at it, but an investigation is already underway. The incident came as the Namibian administration and the United Nations were saying that the general situation in the country appeared to be calm ahead of tomorrow's polling.
The BBC's Mike Woolridge. The president of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops is calling for an end to abortion on demand. Rena Miller has this report on the bishops' annual conference in Baltimore.
It was 200 years ago that the first Catholic diocese in America was established in Baltimore. Today, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops began 4 days of meetings here. And out of the first day came a rallying cry to end abortion on demand. Archbishop John May of St. Louis told the bishops abortion is the one issue where moral principle stands above all else. He said the only thing the Catholic Church is asking America is, in his words, don't forget the baby. The leaders of the country's largest religious denomination face other tough issues this week, including AIDS prevention, the Middle East, and allegations of sexual molestation of children by the Catholic clergy. For National Public Radio, I'm Rena Miller in Baltimore.
The Supreme Court today removed the last legal obstacle to carrying out a $2.5 billion settlement for victims of the Dalkon Shield birth control device. But compensatory payments may not begin until next spring, and no one can say how many of the nearly 100,000 women with active claims will receive substantial payments. The justices, with only one dissenting vote, rejected a challenge by some 650 women to the settlement reached with A.H. Robbins Company. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 47 points today to close at 2582.17. This is NPR News. The U.S. Attorney's Office filed a civil suit today against the owners of a Yugoslav freighter that ran aground off the Florida coast last week, causing an estimated $9 million in damage to a fragile live coral reef. The complaint, filed in U.S. District Court in southern Florida, called the 475-foot freighter unseaworthy and charged its Yugoslav crew with negligence for running aground last Monday, about 75 miles off the Key West coast. The granddaughter of Spanish artist Pablo Picasso has been the victim of one of the largest art thefts in French history. And as Lynn Terry reports from Paris, some of Picasso's works are among the masterpieces.
The thieves entered Marina Picasso's villa in Cannes on the French Riviera early Sunday morning while she was spending the weekend in the Alps. Her two-story 19th-century home is in an exclusive district in Cannes that's set in its own park. Marina Picasso's two security guards were not there at the time. One was on vacation, and police said the other one had left the villa for about an hour to run an errand. Authorities also said the doors and the gates of the building were not forced. Her guard dogs were locked up at the time, and the villa's electronic alarm was not on or didn't work. Police said 12 of her most expensive works were stolen, including five by Pablo Picasso, a painting by French artist Henri Matisse, and another by Flemish painter Peter Bruegel. The masterpieces are worth about $17 million. Police suspect the theft was carried out by one person. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
An insurance company has agreed to pay former USS Iowa sailor Kendall Truitt $100,000 in the death of a crewmate who the Navy blames for a shipboard explosion that killed 47 people. The policy, taken out a year ago by Clayton Hartwig, with Truitt as a beneficiary, played a part in the initial Navy investigation of the disaster aboard the USS Iowa. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Philip Lopate was asked to write an essay for an anthology about the Old Testament, he wrote about growing up in the era of biblical movie epics, which led him to reflect on the influence of the Samson and Delilah story on his love life. Lopate writes personal essays, many of them are quite funny, in which he wrestles with intellectual confusion and ambivalent feelings. His collection, Bachelorhood, Tales of the Metropolis, has just been reprinted, and he has a recent collection called Against Joie de Vivre. The title essay is about his distaste for people who make a spectacle of their hearty enjoyment of life. His other essays are about the problems of living upstairs from your landlord, shaving off your beard and seeing your face for the first time in years, how movie-going can become a substitute for living, and the suicide of a colleague. Lopate is also the author of the novel The Rug Merchant. He's on the selection committee of the New York Film Festival and teaches at Columbia University's graduate writing program. I asked Philip Lopate to explain joie de vivre and why he hates it.
Well, joie de vivre is a French expression for the joy of life. And I'm not sure that I do hate it, but I wrote this essay against joie de vivre partly because there's something perverse in me which likes to explore minority opinions or opinions that are different from the usual. And it seems to me that everybody's running around trying to be so happy and to take pleasure. And so what would happen if I had a kind of anti-hedonistic position and ran with it as far as I could. And essentially I have nothing against joie de vivre, but I have a lot against a kind of desperate pleasure hunting which denies the amount of sadness and sorrow that is inevitably in the world, or at least it seems to me that way.
As an example of what you mean, let me ask you to read a passage from your essay against joie de vivre.
Okay. Ah, what a twinkle in the eye the old man has. He'll outlive us all. So we speak of old people who bore us when we wish to honor them. We often see projected onto old people this worship of the life force. It is not the fault of the old if they then turn around and try to exploit our misguided amazement at their longevity as though it were a personal tour de force. The elderly, when they are honest with themselves, realize that they have done nothing particularly to be proud of in lasting to a ripe old age and then carrying themselves through 1,000 more days. Yet you still hear an old woman or man telling a bus driver with a chuckle, "Would you believe that I am 84 years old?" as though they should be patted on the back for still knowing how to talk, or as though they had pulled a practical joke on the other riders by staying so spry and mobile. Such insecure, wheedling behavior always embarrasses me. I will look away rather than meet the speaker's eyes and be forced to lie with a smile, "Yes, you are remarkable," which seems condescending on my part and humiliating to us both. Like children forced to play the cute part adults expect of them, some old people must get confused, trying to adapt to a social role of indeterminate standards, which is why they seem to whine, "I'm doing all right, aren't I, for my age?" It is interesting that society's two most powerless groups, children and the elderly, have both been made into sentimental symbols. In the child's little hungry hands grasping for life, joined to the old person's frail, slipping fingers hanging on to it, you have one of the commonest advertising metaphors for intense appreciation. It is enough to show a young child sleeping in his or her grandparent's lap to procure joie de vivre overload.
When you express cynicism about sentimental symbols...
Yes.
Do friends get really irritated with you and think that you're a grouch or a killjoy or that you're incapable of feeling certain obvious human emotions?
Sometimes they get very irritated at me. The thing is that I don't really think of myself as a consistent curmudgeon. It's a pose I take in order to explore some material. It's a voice, in a way. As you know from having read the book, there's a wide range of attitudes and postures in the book, and sometimes I think it's very life-embracing, and sometimes it's comic, and sometimes it's sad. But I think that if people get annoyed at me for being a curmudgeon, then I have to accept that, since in part I'm writing this way to provoke them, just to sort of overturn some of the common ideas. For instance, I love old people and I love children, but I don't like the manipulation of the sentimentality involved with them.
Mm-hmm. You write that you associate certain joie de vivre rituals with depression. Would you explain that?
I started seeing a lot in the 70s, the me decade era, people taking care of themselves more and more and, you know, becoming obsessed with physical fitness and the food they put into their system. And often when I was around them, I would get a kind of a sense of sadness coming underneath it, you know. And it often seemed to me that if only they would just be sad, then we could both get beyond it. But because they were running away from some kind of interior pain so much and denying it, then the whole thing smacked of depression to me. I'm not saying that everybody, is depressed. I'm saying that the whole phenomenon of personal self-actualization and all the sort of psychobabble does seem to me to have a tonality which is close to warding off depression.
Do you ever find yourself getting depressed when you're around somebody who's really happy because happiness doesn't come that easy to you?
What a personal question and a good one. I would say that what bothers me more is feeling that somebody is unhappy and that I've got to put up with the false mask of everything being okay. This is a funny thing to say, but sometimes when you'll have a friend and the friend will be very manic and a little hysterical, and then sometimes you'll see her or him in a bad moment in their life, and they'll become much more appealing. You know, you feel like you have access to them in a way.
I know what you mean, but sometimes you wonder if that's because of your own insecurity that you appreciate other people's weaknesses and understand them so well.
Thank you, Terry. I needed that.
No, I mean, I didn't mean you personally. I meant that was a we.
Yeah. A you and a we. A lot of what I'm trying to do in the personal essay form is to play with the idea of you, I, and we.
You mean of getting to the we through the I?
Getting to the we through the I. I think that I'm trying to create a singular, somewhat idiosyncratic I, a first person, who won't claim to be we all the time. Sometimes mm-hmm. when I read lifestyle articles in magazines, I'm insulted because they say we are like this and we do this, and I think, hey, maybe you busted, but not me. You know? So what I'm trying to do is to sort of create a kind of singular persona mm-hmm. and say, you know, listen, you may disagree with me, you know, this may grab you the wrong way, or you may really love it, but in any case, you know, you are not I. And then underneath that is the larger promise that because each of us is alone and singular, there is a kind of universal experience that we do share.
My guest is writer Philip Lopate, and his new book is a collection of essays called Against Joie de Vivre. Now, your previous book of personal essays, Bachelorhood, had several essays about being single. Are you still single?
I am still single, but I have a girlfriend. She'll be happy that I said that on the air.
Are you shy about saying that? Or does this make it more official to acknowledge it on the air?
Well, it is official. It's funny because my writing in many ways is so personal and I confess so many things. And yet, in another sense, I still feel fairly private about my private life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to reconcile that except to say that I create a persona, Philip Lopate, on the page, and he tells things, mainly about the past.
Exactly, things that are kind of at a safe distance and have been resolved?
Yes, and if, when someone starts to ask me about my life right now, I definitely want to protect it somewhat.
Well, I always think that the present is never in focus as clearly as the past is.
Definitely. Now, this whole idea of being single, when I wrote about it in Bachelorhood, and in fact I carry it on in the Genshuan Riva a little, has to do with a kind of a detached perspective and the role of the sort of roving anthropologist who sort of, you know, looks in on people's lives and doesn't allow himself to be pinned down. And I was really creating a kind of character, a bacheloric character who was very suitable to me in the same way, let's say, that Buster Keaton created a Buster Keaton character. Buster Keaton didn't really fall over himself or do the things he did, you know, in real life. So this is somebody who is who both is me and is not me, in a sense.
Well, that being said, I was wondering if you distrust marriage at all. You've been married once.
I'm a great fan of marriage for other people. like most bachelors, I'm very sentimental about marriage. So I have absolutely nothing ideologically against marriage. You know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with it. And I think that I would like to get married again. This is the kind of thing that I say, and then when you watch my behavior, it doesn't always jive exactly, you know. I don't know. I think that I must associate being a writer with having my own space, being alone, being able to control things in that way. So that if I did or do get married again, I'll have to figure out a way to protect that notion of myself. I think some men or women who are married continue to give off vibes that are very much like bachelors, you know.
Are you the kind of writer who really needs to be not only in a room by yourself, but in an apartment by yourself in order to really figure out what you think?
That's true. That's it. Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, your persona, and your real life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Philip Lopate, and his new book is a collection of personal essays called Against Joie de Vivre. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Philip Lopate, and his previous books include a collection of essays called Bachelorhood and the novel The Rug Merchant. Well, we were just talking about marriage, pro and con. And I was wondering if you did get married again, what kind of ceremony you'd want to have? Because you have a very funny essay about how much you dislike it when people write their own ceremony, write their own vows.
Yes, I wrote this essay called Revisionist Nuptials because I kept getting invited to these weddings where people were rewriting the ceremonies and reading poems or putting them in strange places or making large marriage vows, which seemed very pretentious to me. I think I would probably go to City Hall or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and be the lamb led to the slaughter instead of trying to control the whole thing.
In one of your essays, you write about how when you were young, you kind of defined yourself by your taste in films. You hated Bergman, loved Godard.
Yes.
And that you learned, after experiencing a lot of pain yourself, that real pain didn't have the poetic transcendence of pain in film.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you were around 17, you tried suicide.
Yeah.
And you left a suicide note that quoted both Paul Goodman and Freud.
Right.
Who were you expecting to read the note, and why did you quote them? Which parts did you quote?
I think I actually quoted a line saying, from Goodman saying, it's impossible for anyone to imagine his own suicide, in which I was, in a sense, explaining my inability to really, that I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was doing it anyway. And the whole, I think anybody who lives so much in books and films gets a hunger for life to take this kind of form, to take a kind of form of beauty and meaning and lyricism. And at that time, I just felt that there was an enormous distance between the beauty of the world as it was represented in films and books, even when it was a story of intense suffering, and the sort of banal day-to-day nagging pain that I was feeling. And of course, I was also going through, you know, a real adolescent identity crisis, and it's a difficult time for even the most well-balanced person, adolescence. And I think what the rest of my life has been is a search to find form in daily life, so that when I write about it, I keep diaries a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about diaries is that you'll have an experience, you know, you'll go to the dry cleaner and you'll have a little exchange or something like that. And then you'll come home and you'll get on the phone with a friend and you'll start to tell them what had happened. And sometimes as you're telling the anecdote, it will vanish in your hands. You realize that there is no point to the anecdote. And what I did when I kept diaries was I wrote down all kinds of things. And sometimes just in the act of writing them down, they would begin to find a form. So that was what was very satisfying for me, was to work with the materials of daily life until I understood them at least enough so that to me they had a kind of shape.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one other thing about your suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after you had taken around 20 tranquilizers,
mm-hmm.
threw up,
mm-hmm.
and got shipped off to the hospital where your stomach was pumped, did anyone ever read that note or did you destroy it first?
That's a really good question. I wonder what happened to that note. I never destroyed it. I had about four roommates. As I write in the that particular essay, I had taken all these pills, and earlier I had had a meal at the Columbia dining hall, and Columbia was famous for its terrible institutional food, and they had beef stew, some really terrible beef stew, and then I had drunk a quart of orange juice, Tropicana orange juice, to take the pills with, you know, and then I lay down to die, you know. And the combination of the beef stew and the orange juice and the pills just was not working, you know. And here I thought I was going to sort of like drift off in a bark, you know. It didn't work that way at all, you know. Instead, it was a kind of anti-peristalsis. So I don't know what peristalsis, but anyway, I could not digest the food. And since then, I've had a very hard time drinking Tropicana orange juice. And beef stew is not one of my favorite dishes.
But the note, you don't know if anyone read it or not.
I don't know what happened to the note. I'd be glad to reprint it in my collected works, but I think this was not my finest moment as a writer, actually.
Did you think when you were trying to take your life that it would be kind of Greta Garbo-ish in its way? You know, that you'd be lying there kind of beautiful and intelligent and tranquil, and instead there you were like throwing up.
it's really a kind of a metaphor for the way I write, you know, because there's this messy and then there's the neat. I don't think Greta Garbo was my model. I felt myself to be very,
yeah,
very, very unimportant.
Uh-huh.
If I had only imagined myself Greta Garbo, then I never would have tried to kill myself. But I just felt like a very anonymous kid who I was, you know, there's a lot of rage in any suicide. You know, people, I find even now that whenever I'm angry and I can't release the anger, you know, I start to say, that's it, I can't take anymore, you know. And then even, you know, now to occasionally have suicidal thoughts, it's something like a kind of, you know, a little bit of malaria in the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right, actually, that you think you get morbid energy from the lure of suicide.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like promising yourself that, I always have this treat that I can I can give myself. And it's also a way of sort of turning away from the world, you know, sort of pushing them away.
Well, is the world easier to take knowing that there's always an out, which you really probably won't ever use, but...
Yes, I think particularly for me, because I'm... to characterize myself, I'm a fairly gregarious and sociable person, and and I have a real extroverted side, and then there's this introverted side which makes its demands and out of which I write. So in order to go inside, I sometimes have to push the world away. This world which has been very nice to me and which has been very friendly to me, I have to kind of, I have to get an edge somehow. So sometimes people are surprised that my work is so mocking or occasionally has flashes of misanthropy, because when they see me in social situations, they don't feel me to be that way at all.
You once wrote that as when you were young, you were a goody-goody, but you were never sure whether it's because you were good or whether you were just too timid or too programmed to do otherwise. What do you think, looking back?
I think I was a bit of a goody-goody. Uh-huh. I remember once... this is an embarrassing thing to admit, but I remember once my mother worked, and a lot of my classmates when I was in the second grade or so, third grade, their mother stayed home, you know. And I would go over to their houses to play, and there would be this mother who would bring her little kid milk and cookies, and it seemed like this really wonderful life to have this mother who was your servant, you know, who was there to bring you treats the moment you came in the door. And a lot of my friends, they didn't see it that way. They saw it as the mother hovering over them all the time and never giving them any air. But I remember once going over to this kid's house, and his mother brought him milk and cookies, and then he wanted to go out and play, and she asked him to take the garbage out, and he didn't want to take the garbage out. And I said, "I'll do it, Mrs. Weiss," you know. That's pretty goody-goody, don't you think? I wanted all the mothers to love me. But I think that what's underneath that quote is a kind of troubled relation to virtue. You know, it's almost like, and this is a very Dostoevskian idea, that we know that we're acting out of a free will when we do something that's spiteful or something that's malicious or something that's bad for ourselves or bad for others. But do we know that we're acting out of a free will when we do something that's good? And I think in the long run, we are just as much acting out of our free will. But it's just that sort of lingering sense of guilt about being virtuous. Are we virtuous because we really mean it, or because we don't feel we have enough bravery to do something else?
Or we want praise.
Or we want praise, exactly.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the wonderful interview.
Philip Lopate's latest book of essays is Against Joie de Vivre. His earlier books, Bachelorhood and Being with Children, have recently been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, funk star George Clinton. This is his record, Atomic Dog.
This is a story of famous dog, but the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, counting dog, funky dog. Nasty dog.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's music by the late alto saxophonist Art Pepper. There's a huge new collection of Pepper's later recordings, 16 compact discs in all, with more than 50 previously unreleased tracks. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us if it's worth the $200 price tag. Also today, we talk with poet and essayist John Haynes. When he first moved to Alaska, it wasn't even a state yet. In the decades since, Haynes has tried to capture the voice of the American North. And TV critic David Bianculli examines how Nightline went from a 15-minute late-night news spot to one of the most honored shows in broadcast journalism, and how Ted Koppel went from a fill-in host to a star. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Hundreds of thousands of East Germans demonstrated against their government tonight, criticizing new travel guidelines proposed by East Berlin officials. Deidre Berger reports from Leipzig.
For the seventh Monday in a row, Leipzig citizens took to the streets to demand democratic reforms and free elections. Tonight, the loudest demands were for the resignation of the government and the dismantling of the secret police. Many demonstrators said a proposed new travel law that would allow 30 days a year of travel to the West falls short of unrestricted travel freedom. Similar protests came at demonstrations tonight in Halle, Dresden, Magdeburg, and other East German cities. Meanwhile, thousands of East German refugees continue to cross the West German border through Czechoslovakia. Since Friday, more than 23,000 East Germans have crossed the border. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Leipzig.
UN officials announced today that leaders of the Nicaraguan Contras have agreed to meet government officials of Nicaragua this week for the first direct peace talks in more than a year. When President Ortega canceled a 19-month-old truce last week, he also proposed a meeting at UN headquarters. And according to a UN spokesman, the two sides have now agreed to meet Thursday and Friday. Bush administration officials are praising the Israeli cabinet for approving a U.S. proposal for Israeli-Palestinian talks. Israel's acceptance came with six demands, but U.S. officials are not indicating concern. Barry Schweid has more.
One of the Israeli demands is that the U.S. walk out if Israel does. Another is an ironclad guarantee the PLO will be excluded. Secretary of State James Baker has already revised his proposal to try to overcome some Israeli concerns. The result was the cabinet's qualified acceptance of the plan on Sunday. The State Department and the White House called it a positive step, a constructive one. So far as the Israeli demands, U.S. officials say any request for clarification from any of the parties will be considered. So the U.S. is taking Israel's yes to mean yes, and officials say they are now looking to word from Egypt. The Egyptians, in turn, are waiting to hear from the Palestine Liberation Organization on whether Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza will be able to hold talks with Israel. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Both sides are blaming each other for the collapse of a weekly series of talks to end a walkout by more than 47,000 Boeing Company workers. A union spokesman is quoted as saying workers nearing their fifth week on strike will hold firm in the picket lines, and no Boeing airplanes will be built until Boeing offers more money. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 47 points to close at 2,582.17 on volume of some 136 million shares. Trading was light as declining issues led advances 4-1.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new boxed set of recordings by the late alto saxophonist Art Pepper. Pepper was one of the key figures in West Coast jazz in the 1950s, but this box includes more than 18 hours of music Pepper taped for the Galaxy record label in the 4 years before his death in 1982. Pepper had gained notoriety for his experiences as a narcotics addict, which he detailed in his harrowing autobiography, Straight Life. But Kevin says Pepper should be remembered for his music.
Galaxy Recordings of Art Pepper is a 16 CD box set with an axe to grind. It's meant to prove to any remaining skeptics that Art Pepper, in his final years, was one of the greatest alto saxophonists of his time. The box is only slightly too much of a good thing. Pepper did have a weakness for playing a few tunes over and over, especially on the live stuff that makes up almost half of the set. But this marathon remains gripping because his playing does. Art Pepper's the only horn player on these sides, but he's found in various settings. Solo, trio, quartet, quintet with guitar, and in duets with his favorite pianist, George Cables. Pepper also recorded with a string orchestra, augmented by Howard Rumsey's electric guitar, for a session of classic ballads. He played a couple of typically lovely Harold Arlen melodies, but Hoagy Carmichael's Winter Moon let Pepper really indulge his melancholy side. Art Pepper also played superb clarinet, which, like his alto, had a warm and wistful sound. The core of Pepper's work was bebop played on the alto saxophone, the cryingest of jazz horns. Early in his career, he'd combined the Quicksilver lines of Charlie Parker with the slightly softer and cooler sound favored by West Coast musicians. In his later years, he was also influenced by tumultuous free jazz. At times, he'd play lines directly inspired by John Coltrane. More often, though, Pepper would use the energy, excitement, and turbulence of free jazz as seasoning to heighten the tension of his bebop. No other bopper embraced those sounds so unabashedly. Art Pepper's frenzied outbursts gave his solos an unpredictable edginess that kept you off balance. I saw Art Pepper play three times over the last year of his life, including the last show he ever did. Pepper could be nerve-wracking to watch. He might take a full minute to mumble an introduction to a tune, but once he began to play, he was flawlessly eloquent. He would deliberately work himself into an agitated state before performing, so he could let that tension pour out of his horn. Pepper knew his time was short, and he was playing for keeps. If you're a well-heeled Art Pepper fan, this $200-plus box contains enough new music to offer serious temptation. There are 53 previously unreleased tracks. If you're a more casual admirer, Pepper's original Galaxy records are still in print. I'm partial to the quartet albums Art Pepper Today and Straight Life, the set of duets with George Cables called Goin' Home, and the strings date Winter Moon. They're good introductions to the man who always wanted to be, and came close to becoming, the greatest alto saxophonist in the world.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the complete Galaxy recordings of Art Pepper. This is Fresh Air. From the day my guest John Haynes set foot in Alaska, he said he knew he was home. It was just after World War II, and as Haynes would write later, something in me identified with that landscape. I had come, let's say, to the dream place. Haynes is one of Alaska's best known and most acclaimed writers. His poems and essays about living off the land and the Alaskan wilderness have won the praise of other nature writers, such as Barry Lopez, who says that Haynes has kept a vigil on the frontier where most of us, I suspect, would have finally run out of patience, done in by the loneliness. When Haynes built his cabin in Richardson, 60 miles from Fairbanks, he had to hunt moose to keep from going hungry. But now he has a good car and can drive 30 miles to the grocery. For the past few years, he's only lived in his cabin part-time. Haynes has written a memoir called The Stars, the Snow, the Fire. I asked him to read an excerpt.
The wilderness is open, and whoever enters it knows the satisfaction of being at ease in a country he calls his own. The land belongs to him and to no one else. He can go where he likes, following his own trail through the spruce bogs and across the dry birch hills, a pathway tramped in the snow, to stop at nightfall in his own snug camp.
What first brought you to Alaska?
The end of World War II, in part, the fact that I was at loose end, so to speak, and out of the Navy, and the Alaska Highway had just opened up to civilian travel, and there was a lot of news in the papers about people going north to Homestead. And I might not have done it at that particular time if it had not been for the fact that as a friend of mine had discussed going up there with someone else, and they asked me to join them. And everything sort of led from that. And long before that, I had, as a boy, I urged to go into the woods someplace and make a home. I didn't connect it with Alaska, but that's the way it turned out to be.
Well, you did homestead, and you built a cabin in Richardson, Alaska. What did it take to homestead, to get the land that you built the cabin on?
Well, in those days, Alaska was not a state, as you may know. It was a territory. And most of the land here was federally owned, and it meant that you could go almost anywhere. I mean, anywhere outside of a town, as long as it was not an Indian reservation, and take up a piece of land and live on it. Any amount of land, for one reason or another, could be obtained that way. And I just found a piece that I liked, as I said, near Richardson, and filed on it and got patent for it some years later.
It seems to me that there's at least two things that have attracted you to Alaska. One is the sense of living on the frontier, but the other is the solitude that it affords. What is it in you that needs that kind of solitude?
Well, I've always had an ambivalent attitude towards solitude. On the one hand, needing it for certain reasons, and on the other, not feeling entirely comfortable with it. I mean, I have a gregarious side to me. I enjoy people. But I think the fundamental solitude was necessary in order for me to learn certain things that I could not have learned any other way. And as I said in one of the essays in The Stars, There's No Fire, that there's just something about a certain kind of life that you can only learn by plunging into it and killing animals and dealing in blood and things of that sort. And there's no other way to do it. You can't do it by sitting in an office somewhere and imagining it.
What are some of the things you think you've learned by living alone in the wilderness and having to hunt for your own food?
Well, I think I learned something essential about living in a certain place. I think that this was a very good lesson for me, and I've tried to explain that in essays here and there, that something essential in human life is approached in that way. And anybody who farms and plants and tends animals will understand what I mean. It's a life that goes back to a very early time in human history. And I think periodically some of us at least, and perhaps humanity itself, needs to return some distance in that direction and to relearn these lessons. And certainly individually, some of us are, for one reason or another, led to do that. And that's essentially what it was about.
Do you ever lose track of the days?
Nope. Yes. Yes, I lose track of a lot of things, but not usually the days, no. I don't listen to the radio. I get enough bad news from the newspapers, and but I have, you know, I pay attention to that. Yeah.
You say that you were born as a poet in Alaska, that you started writing poetry while living there. How did you start writing in Alaska?
I started writing, I say seriously, the first winter I spent at the cabin of Richardson. And the reason I started writing is rather mysterious, but I had been studying art, painting and sculpture back east before I came to Alaska. And I assumed that when winter shut down that I would get my paints out and set up easel and canvas and paint. And I discovered I wasn't going to be able to do that for any number of reasons, lack of light. But I needed some way of responding to the experience, you see. And so I began writing. I didn't know quite what I was writing or what I was going to do with it, but I knew enough about poetry, for example. And that's how it started. I had to get something down. I had to find some way to express my feeling about things and my reaction to the country and simply being there.
Can I ask you to read a short poem for us of yours?
Yeah, I will do that. And I'll read something out of the first book, Winter News, and it just is a brief, I would say, a description or a presentation of a certain mood inside the house and at the end of a day, and in the fall, obviously, and winter is coming on, and there's a certain quietness into things, and certain things have been done and accomplished, and you have a sense of the year drawing toward an end. And it's a kind of dying away of things. The leaves have fallen, winter is coming on, and you have this sense of a certain finality. And that's mainly what's in the poem. Listening in October. In the quiet house, a lamp is burning, but the book of autumn lies open on a table. There is tea with milk in heavy mugs, brown raisin cake, and thoughts that stir the heart with the promises of death. We sit without words, gazing past the limit of fire into the towering darkness. There are silences so deep, you can hear the journeys of the soul, enormous footsteps downward into breezing earth.
In a previous book of yours, you mentioned that to find a literature of the North You had to look to the literature of other countries because the far north really hasn't been part of the American consciousness.
Right. I would say that, yeah.
Do you think that writers such as yourself now living in Alaska will change that in some way?
Well, I think that I have, to some extent, initiated something of that sort. I suppose I could claim that some of my poems, not all, because I've written poems about many, many other things, but at least the first poem that I published in book form did present something new, and it has been called the first serious poems of the far north in American literature, and maybe that's true and maybe it isn't, but I think it's a fair guess. Other people have been since writing and adding to it in some way, but as I say, I think this is, we're still very much at the beginning of what I would call a serious literature from this part of the world.
Frontiers, especially last frontiers like Alaska, become very symbolic in a lot of people's minds, and to some people who go there, they're seeking some transformation that they can't find where they are. They're kind of at the place of last resort, and I think I've run into a lot of drifters and losers who think that their fate's going to change when they get there, when they get to Alaska. And I wonder if you've run into a lot of people like that yourself.
Yeah, I'd say that there were quite a few dead-enders here in Alaska, as you find them elsewhere. But it's the illusion of, you know, the last place to go. And, I mean, the last frontier is a cliché, in a sense, and in another sense, it's a very real thing. But it attracts all kinds of people, good and not so good. But for one reason or another, I think people come here often. They do find something of themselves, if nothing else. But it is a place where you you tend to meet up with certain things in yourself, or simply in the world around you that. Are not always easy to face, to understand, and to make sense of, and make some good use of.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for your patience, and I hope I've said something worth listening to.
John Haynes' memoir, The Stars, the Snow, the Fire, is published by Gray Wolf Press. He spoke to us from station KUAC in Fairbanks. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Doing any previews of the elections?
Yes, we are. We'll have a report from Cleveland on the mayoral election, which takes place tomorrow. Also from New York City, where they're electing a new mayor. And also from Morenci, Michigan. We rest assured that you haven't been following that one very closely. We'll also be hearing about more emigration from East Germany and big demonstrations once again in cities throughout the East, as some West German leaders have urged the East Germans that emigration will not be an answer to the German question.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Wednesday is the 10th anniversary of ABC's late-night news show, Nightline. Audiences have come to rely on Ted Koppel's incisive questioning each night. But when the program first started, Koppel wasn't the anchor, and the show wasn't called Nightline. TV critic David Bianculli takes a look back.
This is an ABC News special. The Iran crisis. America held hostage. From Washington, correspondent Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. The special report that we planned to bring you tonight was about domestic politics, the battle among the Democrats. But we think the crisis in Iran is more urgent right now than the campaign here at home.
Everybody associates Nightline with Ted Koppel, but the story actually begins with a guy named Rune Arledge, who at the time was ABC president of both the news and sports divisions. In sports, he had given TV the instant replay, ABC's wonderful Olympics coverage, and Monday Night Football. But in news, Arledge had yet to make his mark, and he wasn't getting much help from the local ABC stations. Those affiliates resisted his idea of a late-night news show. Their locally broadcast movies made too much money, and there was no proof that audiences were hungry for more news. Remember, 1979 was 1 year before the launch of CNN. But Arledge didn't give up. Instead, he waited for a news story that was so high profile that might last so long he could schedule a series of late-night specials that the affiliates couldn't refuse. On day 6 of the hostage crisis, Arledge launched his first special. The technology was used brilliantly, the news was late-breaking, and the ratings were good. Only one ingredient was missing, a host who could pull it all together effectively. 3 weeks after the Iran crisis series began, a substitute host provided that ingredient.
Day 26. Now here is correspondent Ted Koppel.
Good evening. It had all been arranged. As soon as the Shah's doctors gave him a clean bill of health, he would leave New York and return to Mexico. Until this evening. In a stunning reversal, the Mexican government, which had indicated all along that the Shah would be welcome to take up residence there, tonight made it clear that the deal was off.
Very quickly, Koppel earned the job full-time. He wrote like a poet, juggled the incoming satellite TV signals like a master, and cross-examined his guests like a lawyer. Even so, it took almost 6 months for Koppel, Arledge, and ABC to stake their permanent claim on the coveted late-night slot. But finally, on day 142 of the hostage crisis, they made their move.
Good evening. This is a new broadcast in the sense that it is permanent and will continue after the Iran crisis is over. There will also be nights when Iran is not the major story, when we'll bring you briefly up to date on Iran, but we'll focus on some other story. That's not the case tonight. Again, today, Iran is the major story, and for the first time on television, we'll provide the opportunity for the wife of an American hostage to speak live with an Iranian official.
Koppel has been at his post ever since, and he's the most skilled on TV at what he does. On Nightline, he's done some unforgettable shows, interviews with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, visits to South Africa and the Middle East, and during last month's earthquake coverage, he was simply magnificent. Some people wonder why Koppel hasn't moved on to something else, but where would he go? He's got one of the best jobs on TV and one of the best shows.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblitis, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Burgin directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the world's foremost violinists, Shlomo Mintz, and one of the fathers of funk, George Clinton. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward talks about two of the men behind the Sound of Philadelphia, Gamble and Huff. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.